All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And Michelle is going to introduce our speaker tonight.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Michelle, and I am an alcoholic and an addict. It's my privilege to introduce our speaker tonight. He is one of the first people I met in the program. I hold him very dear to my heart. He reached out to me on my very first day, and he made me feel welcome. He made me feel understood, and he made me feel accepted. And he said something very important to me that day. He said, "You never have to be alone again." And thank you so much for that, Don. Please welcome Don Bryan.
Hey, family, my name is Don Bryan, and now I'm a real alcoholic. And it's by God's grace and the company I keep, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug today, and for that I'm really grateful. And I want to thank everybody in this room for being here, because I can't do this by myself. My sobriety date is April 5th, 1995, and my home group is the Heavy Hitters Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm going to do something I normally don't do. I've known some people since I've been in recovery that have never seen me without my glasses on. Never. For 19 years. But I'll make an exception tonight so that y'all can see my eyes. You see, have you ever heard the expression, the eyes are the windows to one's soul? Anybody hear that? My windows are tinted. That's hard. And I got a little confused because I was going to AA meetings, I was going to NA meetings, I was going to CA meetings. And I got confused because in AA we used the big book, and in CA we used the big book. And I couldn't understand what the difference was. And then it was shown to me that made it very clear. You see, in AA, we do our sugar like this. And in CA, we do our sugar like this. Oh, I got a lot of dopeies out here, huh? Okay. All right, singing this to purpose. Okay, hopefully it's really an honor and a privilege to be here to share my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now for anybody to listen to anything that I say is really a miracle in itself. I'm not going to focus too much on what it was like, because everybody knows what it was like. But just to give you some background, I was born in New York. I'm a twin. I have a twin sister, Donna. And then I had triplet sisters after that, 2 years apart, Darlene, Denise, and Diane, were the five D's. And I come from a family of educators. I'm fourth generation college. My great grandfather was a slave, and he became president of West Virginia State University. got names with the building on it, buildings with names on it and all that. So I was always taught, that there's nothing that I can ever have a difficulty with that I couldn't think my way out of it. It was about achievement. Always achieving. So I grew up in New York, Manhattan, in Harlem, 246 West 150th Street, between 7th and 8th Avenue. And I started off with the wrong crowd right from the beginning. I had friends that were ODing at 11 and 12 years old. Some were committed. So I've been around substances and death all my life. My first grandfather died in 63, then my father died in 65, then my paternal grandmother died in 67, then my maternal grandmother died in 80, and my uncle died in 63, and my mother died in 86. I know death. I know it. But as I was growing up, what's it say in the 12 and 12, I was a precarious type. And I always did well in school, never had any problems in school. And I didn't really start, but I felt different. See, I grew up in a household of six women. No father, no uncles. So I learned by being out in the streets. I didn't want to associate with my sisters. Because, you know, they're girls. Three of them are younger than me. So I always felt apart. Not even though I'm the eldest, I didn't ever feel apart. They were playing with dolls and I wanted to play basketball. So got through that. Going through high school, did very well. Was a member of, they had this thing in New Jersey called Boys State. Achievement. I was on a career track to be a lawyer. And I was in all these social clubs for pre-law. I had applied to college as a pre-law student. And here's how my keen alcoholic mind works. I was registering for my classes, and I was in the pre-law line. And right next to me, I saw this young lady who just captured my heart. And she was a speech and drama major. So right then and there, I changed my major. See, I'm compulsive like that. I'm a I don't care type of alcoholic. I don't care about consequences. I don't care. I drink and drug till I die. That's what I do. So I didn't drink much in high school, just a couple beers every now and then. But when I went off to college, I discovered the pleasures of the grape. Fine wine. Boone's Farm. Thunderbird. Sand Supper Time. Wild Irish Rose. Mad Dog. Night Train. Spinata. It wasn't until I was 22 that I found out good wine had a cork. I thought they were always twisted. And I developed the pomposity to be able to consume a lot of alcohol, a lot of wine, without getting drunk. And of course, this was early 70s. So Everybody got high. In fact, alcohol is always a second choice because be a drinker, you were really corny. You were square. Oiler, we used to call him. Oiler. He was oiler. He wasn't cool. So, I did well in school. I didn't do as well as my twin sister. We started college at the same time, went to the same school. She graduated in 3 years as a Fulbright scholarship. And it took me just a little bit longer. Just a little bit. So, a couple years passed. And, while I was in school, probably one of the most profound things I got was the dean of men, who also teach. And he pulled me over to the side and he said, "Mr. Bryan, you have a lot of neuroses that we need to deal with. So what we're going to do, you're going to take my psychology course next semester." I said, "Okay, Dean, not a problem." And since psychology was one of my required courses, because I was a speech and drama major, I'm a theater guy, I took his course. First day of class, he made me stay after class and said, "Look, I'm going to make a deal with you. If you learn this quote and you put it on every test that I give, if you don't answer any other questions, if you put this on the piece of paper, on the test, you'll never get lower than a C." I said, "Great, Dean, what is that?" He said, "It's a quote by Carl Jung, and it goes, 'Humility comes with the conquest of insecurity and the ability to take oneself for granted.' Humility comes with the conquest of insecurity." Steps 1 through 9. "And the ability to take oneself for granted." Step 12. "Being of service. Understanding that I'm not all that and a bag of potato chips." So, I get out of college and I call up my old roommate. A couple years pass, I call him up. I say, "What's happening?" He said, "I need some help with this theater." I said, "Can you put me up?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'll be down in 2 days." So I quit my job. I was working as a fundraising consultant. Quit my job, flew down to Atlanta, and I made a mistake. I drank the water. I've been here ever since. And so because we were trained in college to be professionals, to work at the highest level. And so we did that. We started off with this little theater. It was community based. They had a budget of about $20,000 a year, and they were $22,000 in the red. So we said, what we're going to do is we're going to tap into the black middle class. And the way we do that is by we present them with a season, and we do something that was never done in Atlanta. We have season ticket subscribers. So we build up a base of people who are purchasing their tickets 6-8 months in advance for a show, buying their tickets in April for a show that wasn't going to take place until October, because we had the backing of Theater of the Stars. So we did a season ticket campaign, and then after a while, about a year, we decided we really wanted to go professional. So we negotiated a contract with Actors Equity and became one of the only professional black theaters in the Southeast, where if I hired you, Philip, this is your job now. This is your job. We're going to pay you a salary. We're going to pay pension and welfare. We're going to pay insurance. This is your job. Because in order to be good, you have to be around good. And good professionals. See? At any time, 90% of all actors are unemployed. For black actors, it's 96% to 97%. So the advantage we had, I was able to call up people that you see on TV or in the movies and call them up and have them come down to Atlanta, because you're going to get a check. We're going to put you up in the hotel. We're going to have other ancillary projects for you to do while you're here. And they would jump at it. And so we did that. And it was fun. And my drinking started progressing. I used to be... Anybody here remember Country Place? It was on the corner of 14th and Peachtree? No? Okay. They used to have happy hour there. It was a dollar a drink, top shelf. And I used to go there every day. Eventually became honorary mayor of Country Place. There was only one person ahead of me, and that was the governor, because he spent more time there than I did. And we would go to Country Place, and then that was on Friday, goof on Saturday, and then on Monday... The guys I went to college with, we would get together for Monday night football, and everybody had to bring a six pack, minimum. You couldn't bring any Hams or Schaefer, or it had to be Beck's Guinness Stout. And I would drink, and we'd have a good time. This went on for about 10 years. And then I was doing this show one time. And this guy said to me, "What are you doing after the show, Don?" I said, "Nothing, just hanging around." He said, "You want to do some cocaine with me?" I said, "No, I don't want any cocaine. See, I burnt out my nasal passages in college. I can't smell anything. What we used to do, and I apologize for straying from singleness of purpose, but it's part of my story. It'll make sense later. We used to take roaches from joints and put them in tissue paper, and then take match heads and tear those off, put those in the tissue paper, roll it up, and then set it on fire and inhale it. All the sulfur going. So I burnt out my nose, my nasal passages. I don't smell it very well. So I said, "No, man, I'm not going to snort any cocaine. It's a waste of time." He said, "No, man, we're not going to snort it. We're going to smoke it." I said, "Yeah." So we went to this place, and I did it. And I had never had that feeling before. Now, I've done all types of drugs. I've done barbiturates, black beauties, red devils, 714 quaaludes, mescaline, peyote, opium, psilocybin, heroin, and nothing did for me what that did. And I said, "I found what I've been looking for all my life." So because I was a pillar in training, you heard about a pillar of the community? Well, I was a pillar in training, and I had a public image to keep up. I just became a weekend warrior. So I get high on Friday night and Saturday night, rest Sunday, and start Sunday. Continually drinking now. I'm always drinking. And then Friday and Saturday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then Friday, Saturday, Sunday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Wednesday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I got high every day. I smoked cocaine for 14 years. And you see, I was one of those stuck up elitist, get high people. Some people would do it, indulge, and they start looking out the windows, looking out the door, hearing knocks. That never happened to me. What happened to me was, I would become a cotton picker. I'd take a hit. All night long, 4 days. I'd be on the floor so much, sometimes my back would lock up.
And I couldn't get up.
And I had a friend, Tony, and he'd say, "Man, why don't you get off the floor?" I said, "Yo, man, I'm not messing with nobody. Leave me alone. Man, let me enjoy what I'm doing." Now, I told you all that I don't care alcoholic. See, I don't care. I don't care. I never had the consequences that other people had. I never got arrested for anything. I never caught a case. Only had one speeding ticket in my whole life. I always ended up in ICUs. Piedmont, Grady, Crawford Long, Georgia Baptist, St. Joseph's, Northside, Southside, Norfolk. I drink and drug till I die. Can you imagine being in the ICU and still getting high? I remember I was convalescing because all my air passages had gotten blocked from what I didn't know. I was having these headaches, these migraines, seeing stars and everything. And I had a remedy for that. Headache would go away. And what happened? One night, my face got all swollen. My throat got all swollen. I couldn't breathe and I couldn't talk. And my play sister, Lark, took me to Grady, to the emergency room. And I'm staying there for hours and hours and hours. They finally get to me. And they did an MRI and said, all my air passages were blocked. If they don't operate on me right now, I'll be dead. Came from an impacted tooth that had poisoned my whole system. So if you have a toothache, that's something you don't want to mess around with. Go get it checked out. Now, while I was in intensive care for 9 days and another 28 days on the ward, and not once did I think about getting better. What did I think about? I got out the hospital. Before I got off the hospital grounds, my guy drove by. He said, "Let's," and I said, "Go." And that was in March of 95. And so, I don't have a problem. See, I didn't have a problem with alcohol and drugs. The only time I had a problem was when the money ran out. Then I had a cash flow crisis. Everybody goes through that, cash flow crisis. So I'm at this party, this theater party, and I'm throwing down these beers. Must have done 2 6-packs in an hour. And that's when I received a moment of clarity. I said, something's wrong with this picture. I'm not high, and I don't have to go to the bathroom. Something is wrong. So I had a friend who was in this program, and a college buddy, and I called him up, and he said, meet me at 2775 Glenwood. I said, okay. All night, I'm debating. Lord, you know, if I go do this AA thing, everybody's going to know I'm an alcoholic dope fiend. And she said, Don, they already do. See, I was the last to know. I didn't realize I was delusional and that I had a perception problem. I could look in the mirror and think I saw what I saw, but it wasn't true. So I meet Oinantis at this clubhouse, and he says, you know, this AA program is spiritual, it's not religious, it's really spiritual, it's spiritual in nature. I said, okay. So I go to this meeting. First thing they do is say a prayer. Next thing they do, they pass the basket around. Third thing they do, does anybody want to come join us? I said, I've been bullshitted again. But I had no place else to go. So the plan was, we were going to go to a meeting, get me into treatment. Now, as you see, I'm not a big guy. I put on 60 pounds since I've been in recovery. I came in weighing 115 pounds. I had all my scars from all my surgeries. I had my hair in carrot top dreadlocks. I had my sunglasses. I looked like walking dead. I used to smell like cocaine and alcohol, and I had this shape. So we went to this treatment center, and they said, we're sorry, but you're too much of a health liability. We can't help you. Went to this other place. Sorry. You're too much of a health liability. We can't help you. Went to a third place. Sorry. We can't help you. You're too much of a health liability. Went to this fourth place. And this was the place they took anybody. They said, no, we can't help you. You're too much of a health risk. Went to this last place. And this is how God works in my life. One of the counselors there, I had gone to high school with. Now, she didn't intervene on me or interview me, but I'm sure she put in a word, because they said, here's what we'll do, Don. You stay sober for a week, come back next week, and we'll let you into our outpatient program. I said, if I could stay sober for a week, my little black ass wouldn't be here now. How do I do that? And they said, we don't care how you do it. Just do it. And that's how it's been for me from day one. It's got to be that cut and dry for me. I'm showbiz. People don't care about your feelings. You either do it or I replace you. So I spent my week and got back, got in. Now, I was there for a couple of days, and I was expecting this annuity payment from this car accident that I was in. A little bit of change, about 10 grand. And I told Laura that I was going to pay her the rent I owed her as soon as my check came in. So April 15th came, and the check wasn't there. And I had been going to all these meetings, and they talked about rigorous honesty. Are you willing to go to any length? So, because I was so full of false pride, I'm not going to ask anybody, can I sleep on your sofa? I'm not going to go to a shelter. So my keen alcoholic mind said, I know what I'll do. I'm going to live in the airport. And I lived in Hartsfield Airport for the next 60 days. I would ride Marta at night after a meeting, go to the airport to sleep, wake up about 5:30, ride Marta in the morning till it was time to go to outpatient, because I had to see at this point, was I willing to go to any length? Because I'm a shortcut kid. I'll find a shortcut. I'll make one. And I had to see that. I had to see what was I willing to do. So I got about 90 days. And you know, has anybody heard this in the rooms? Don't get involved with anybody for your first year. Anybody here? I'm scientific poll. Show of hands. Well, it didn't apply to me. So I meet this young lady and we hit it off. Really hit it off. The only complication was she was HIV positive and I'm not. And I had to decide at that point what type of man I wanted to be. I said, I love you. Or am I going to cut and run because it's tough? And Debbie was a consultant for the CDC and the state of Georgia. She helped develop Georgia Women Preventing AIDS. And she used to tour over the country doing HIV education and giving lectures. So we knew how to practice safe sex. So that was the first time when I really started practicing the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So, we're doing great. We're traveling all around the country, going to all these seminars, and see, I had to learn about ego deflation because I was always the star. And now I had to take a back seat to her. So, we go to New York for a friend of mine's wedding. And while we're up there, her speech starts slurring a little bit. And she starts losing her equilibrium. So we come back to Atlanta, have some tests. And she's diagnosed with this disease. I can't pronounce it. I just know the letters PML, and it's like having multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's simultaneously. It creates lesions on the brain with no known treatment and no known cure. It's rapidly progressive and fatal. And I say, oh. How am I going to deal with this? So I'm trying to work a new job. I'm going to meetings. And this is when we had those brick cell phones. I had to have a brick. We had one brick and one in a box. So I'm calling because within a day or two, she lost the ability to walk. So the love we got from these rooms, people would come over to the house and we'd have meetings. Then several, a day or so later, she lost the ability to speak, so we had to converse on the computer, and then lost the ability to do that, so we went to the eye blinking signal system. Yes, no. Then she got placed on hospice, and they said, you need to start making preparations. Hospice is the last stop. So, we were supposed to go to the hospital to have some final tests done. And before that happened, Debbie sat up and asked for a glass of water. Okay. Cool. I used to call her broccoli because she was a vegetable. She couldn't do nothing to me. Yeah, I mean, so what? Leave me alone. Comedy isn't pretty. So we go to the hospital, and they did an MRI. and the lesion on her brain had disappeared. They call her the miracle lady. So we decided, we were engaged, we decided we were going to get married. 2 weeks later, we got married, and she was dancing at her own wedding. And that's when I had my first spiritual experience. Because I saw God do what no human being could do. That's when I said, I'm all in.
With all my chips.
I'm all in. And so a couple of years passes by. So Debbie not only was HIV positive, but she had a hysterectomy. She developed diabetes, became anemic. And you see, she made me such a better man because I could not bring stress into the house. Because stress could kill. So there was no such thing as having an argument. You all taught me that it's better to feel right than to be right. You can win. So, she's having these pains in her side. And so, we had some tests done. And she has gallstones. Okay? Gallstones. So the doctor says, we need to, you know, remove them. I said, well, doc, considering her pre-existing conditions, what is the risk? He said, oh, it's only about 30%. We said, okay. So we talked about it. Now, we had been in a position where we had no chance. I'll take a 30% risk. So we have the operation. And I don't know. From jump, it didn't start off right because they had her on a regular diet and she was a diabetic, so I had to get that straightened out. So we had the operation. She was supposed to leave the operating theater and go into intensive care. So I go into intensive care. She's not there. Oh, she must be back at the operating theater. So I go down to the operating theater. She's not there. They took her back to her room. I go back to her room. She's not there. So I'm walking around this hospital trying to find my wife. And I find her on a gurney in a hallway because somebody forgot to sign the papers to admit her into intensive care. And if it hadn't been for what I learned in these rooms, I would have blown that hospital up. Because I'm a militant, or I used to be. I know how to make a bomb. So we finally get that straight. So I had been there for about 2 days, so I decided to go home. So I go home, and you know how you take your shower, and you, after you've been up for a long time, you finally hit the pillow, and that's when the phone rang. They said, I need to come back down to the hospital. So I come back to the hospital. They say, she's bleeding internally and they can't stop the bleeding. So they're going to have to go do another operation. But before we do that, you need to sign this waiver because this is a very high risk operation. Now, people talk about working the steps is hard. Try signing that. They did the operation. After the operation, she was bleeding from every orifice, her eyes, her ears, her nose, her mouth. They couldn't stop the bleeding. So the doctor comes to me and he says, well, what do you want to do? You want to keep her on life support or you want to take her off? I said, doc, I ain't got that much power. I can't make that decision. Why don't we monitor her for an hour or so, and then we'll make that decision. Well, while that was occurring, she had relatives that had come in, and we were in the ICU, and they had luggage. And you know, ICUs are kind of small. So I said, here's what I'll do. I'll take the luggage down to my car so we could have a little more space. Well, I took the luggage down, and when I came back, Debbie had passed on. Now, as traumatic as that was, what that really was God doing for me
what I couldn't do for myself, because any decision that I made in my own mind's eye would have been the wrong decision. If I kept her on life support, I would have beat myself up for the rest of my life for making her suffer. If I took her off life support, I would have beat myself up for quitting on her, and I've seen a miracle happen. God loves me so much that He took away that decision for me, so I never had to be burdened with that. And that was my second spiritual experience. And since that time, I've had countless spiritual experiences. But I wouldn't have gotten it if I hadn't done the work. See, you don't put anything in, you can't get anything out. On page 14 in the big book, it says, "For if an alcoholic fails to enlarge and perfect his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he will not be able to meet the certain trials and low spots ahead." See, AA has taught me how to hit the curveball. And life throws you curveballs. You can't get in the major leagues if you can't hit a curveball. You stay in double A ball for the rest of your life. Well, I want to play with the pros. I want to play with the pros. So I've learned to see the spin on the curveball. I've learned that. It says in the story, "I will have peace of mind in exact proportion to the peace of mind I bring into the lives of others." I want to be a purveyor of peace. Oh, let me say, I can't do it. But there's this thing. N-O, no God, no peace. K-N-O-W, no God, no peace. And that's what I want. Just to have peace. To be a purveyor of peace. Now, I'm going to see if I can do this. This isn't any AA authorized literature. So if we have any AA cops out there, write me the ticket, I'll pay it. It's called the final analysis. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. People, if you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you've got, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you got anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it's all between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Thank you so much.
Don, thank you so much. That was amazing. Tinsley's going to come up.
My name is Tinsley. And thanks, Don. That's a great story. I love that reading. Everywhere.
promise I won't.